Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust. Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of Expanding Mind. Continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. If you're old enough and you read comic books, you might remember that, and sort of, you know, general weird pulp magazines, 1970s, I think into the 1980s, so you gotta have a couple years under your belt. There used to be advertisements for the Rosicrucians in the comic books. And it's sort of an odd thing, like what is an advertisement for a esoteric Western order of spiritual mysteries doing in a comic book? And today we're going to be talking about one or a whole set of answers to that and many other questions with Dr. Jeffrey Kripal, author of Mutants and Mystics, Science Fiction, Superhero Comics, and the Paranormal, a wonderful and beautiful book, very, very lovely book, one of the most attractive books I've ever seen out of a university press. It looks kind of like a comic book. It has lots of beautiful plates in it, and it's not even that expensive, in which Dr. Kripal goes in and traces the sort of paranormal and mystical background of science fiction, superheroes, and popular culture. And I was just on the chat line with our co-host, Maja Daoust, and she it seems almost a synchronicity here. We've got some serious overlap here, Maja, so why don't you dive right in there?
Yeah, it's true. I just, in my lecture a couple weeks ago, that was the whole topic, was about power and force for the magician, you know? And I'm really obsessive about researching the siddhis, which in yoga are the superpowers you can get. Like, once you achieve a kind of certain level, you get like Superman style, where you go Jesus or Buddha and you can do things like levitate and walk on water and stuff like that. And we've talked a lot about how I'm a huge comic geek and have been since I was, you know, knee high to a grasshopper or whatever. But so you look at the stories of the mystics and the yogis and like all of the different bodhisattvas or whatever, and they're all superheroes. Like, they're all really based on the same abilities and powers that these superheroes in the comics get. They're like almost completely identical. It's like they read the Vedas or they read, you know, all the tantric sutras, and that's what these comic geeks have based all of their big characters on.
Well, you know, what's interesting, it's not just that the powers are similar or, you know, the battles or the flying through the air or whatever, but it's also when you look at the role of, like, the literature of the siddhis, the people who, and the powers and the people who had those powers, they often overlap with things that seem a lot more like popular culture or folklore. I mean, some of these characters were definitely not monks. They were,
right,
you know,
well,
wild
that
characters.
The Sinister Yogi's book, you know, talks
exactly
about, like, yeah.
So you have that sort of sense that it's not necessarily in the central part of the religion in the monasteries with the academic scholars of the religion writing their texts, that it's not necessarily there that you're going to find evidence or suggestions of these, you know, perennial stories of human superpowers. It's a little bit more in the margins, like in the modern world, more likely to be found in a comic book than in a mainstream book of academic psychology. So
yeah, totally. Like, one of my favorites, I'll just really quick say one of my favorites, my friend who's an Hasidic Jew told me that in the Tanya, do you know about the Tanya, that Jewish like bunch of stories, there's a story in there that Jesus starts flying away from these two rabbis and they start having a battle like in midair, and Jesus turns around and he pees in their eyes so that they can't follow him, and they have like this, you know, super power battle in the middle of the sky, and he wins by like peeing on their faces and then flies off.
Wow, that's deeply peculiar.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we haven't scared you away Jeff. You on the line?
Yeah, I'm just here giggling. That's
I'm not surprised. So, you know, one of the things I was just sort of thinking about, you know, in talking about how, not just even in necessarily in modern culture, but in cultures in general, that often, you know, once you have a priestcraft established, once you have something like an academic school of religion or of philosophy, that you're going to tend to find this stuff a little bit more on the margins than in the center of things. And in a way, that kind of applies partly to you because you're a big shot academic scholar, and you know you've got you're head of your department, you're a chair of this and that and da 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 da, and yet you're looking at the stuff that's just not really conventionally seen as part of your field. So I know you've got a big history there, but I'm just curious a little bit about, you know, your story of how you came to be interested in this, you know, relatively marginal material for a scholar of religion.
Well, I'm just in a real serious midlife regression. That's basically it. No, I mean that's part of it. I mean there's a more serious story there, but there's a lot of there's a lot of ways to answer your question, Eric. I was not ever interested in the Siddhi stuff. I mean, I did my early work was actually all in Indian Tantra, Majna. That's what I did back in the 90s and to early turn of the millennium. But I really wasn't that interested in the Siddhi part of it, although the stuff's everywhere. I actually got interested in it through my writing the history of the Esalen Institute and the human potential movement and the whole countercultural matrix out of which all that stuff came. And basically what happened is I talked to lots of people who had these extraordinary experiences, and I realized that A, those experiences were impossible, and B, that they really happened. And so I got really interested in it as a topic and start asking the question why folks like me in the academy who claim to be studying religion are studiously avoiding these types of extremely common religious experiences. Mm. And so, you know, I really got interested in it through the field, through a kind of anthropological encounter with the natives, as it were, who, of course, were me as well. I mean, I did grow up with this stuff. I don't, you know, I remember running into the Rosicrucian ads, Eric. I thought it was some kind of skin disease, and they were, you know, selling a cream or something. As a 12-year-old, you don't know. But what I remember ordering profusely was all of the kung fu and bodybuilding manuals at the back of the comics. And my brother and I spent countless hours, you know, reading over these booklets that were really nothing more than mimeographed sheets of paper with a staple in them that we spent too much money on becoming superheroes in our basement. So there is a bit of midlife regression here, but there's also some very serious and really fascinating questions about why this stuff's off the table for so many people who are otherwise really interested in religion.
Well, why is that? I mean, from your perspective, I mean, there's a lot of ways to talk about it, but you know, I mean, it's especially weird when you just start to consider that anybody who deals with this field, or is even just kind of keeping their minds open, even people who don't really pay attention to this stuff, a lot of people realize that somewhere in their biography, they or someone they know has had some extraordinary experience that just doesn't fit in, and even if they go, well, but it must have just been a weird thing, I don't know what it was. Clearly, these things just keep coming up over and over and over again, and yet it's still kind of a forbidden discussion, even if you're not walking in with some, you know, big unusual theory about why things are the case.
Right. So I think there are two reasons for that, and it's really the same reason on two different poles. If we think about our culture caught somewhere between the titans of religion and science, it's very easy to show that these sorts of experiences violate both of those titans. They call into question both materialist sort of traditional scientific understandings of the world, and they call into question traditional religious understandings of the world. And the way they do that is the basic scientific picture of the world and of the human being is that consciousness is essentially an illusion. It's a froth created by neurons firing in incredibly complex loops in our brains, and that everything we think of as awareness or consciousness is really just a kind of a virtual reality being created by the biology of our brains locked inside our bony skull. And when we die, that all just blips out like a light bulb. So paranormal events are extremely subversive to that worldview, because they almost always involve something happening in the physical world that corresponds perfectly to some kind of mental state.
Well, and that's really interesting in terms of superheroes, just because, like, when you look at all of those kind of mystical feats, when they're interpreted into the comic, it's always a combination of science with that, like, mystical ability, right? I mean, the superheroes and the supervillains always have, like, some kind of high-tech thing, or they were, like, you know, bitten by a mutant spider that was created by genetic alteration. So it's almost like the superhero is a way, or supervillain is a way to, like, interject that into our consciousness, because it uses science to help explain it. I mean, don't you think?
Well, yeah, but it's not really science, of course.
Right.
I mean, that's what my whole book is about, is that basically, you know, if we look 2 centuries ago or 2 or 3 centuries ago, all of these experiences that these artists and authors have had would have been coded in traditional religious or esoteric or magical terms, because that's in fact what they are. They're magical or mystical experiences. Today, with the reign of science and scientific materialism, that's out. You can't go anywhere with that. So you simply come up with what's essentially a fake scientific explanation, like a radioactive spider or getting blasted by an atomic bomb test, and you have that be the generator of the Siddhi, of the superpower.
Mm.
But in fact, if you really get radiated by an atomic blast, you're toast. You know, you don't become a superhero; you get cancer.
Right.
So it's not science. It's a parascientific framework that's actually doing religious or mystical work in the narrative. So that's why these stories look so similar, is because in fact they are similar. We've just moved from a religious register to a para or quasi-scientific one.
Well, but here's a question for you. Let me just, like, maybe lay out the ground a little bit with one way of thinking about this, is that, you know, when we were in the time in human history when religion was so dominant that people didn't even think of it as religion, as anything other than just the way things were, then we see these similar kinds of experiences, and of course they're framed in terms of spirits, of you know, Gnostic powers of the self, of demons, of angels, of holy objects, et cetera, et cetera. You know, then we kind of move along, and then, you know, when science emerges, it's not just that there becomes a new set of explanations. It's almost like human reality shifts a little bit, because we have these machines that are very good at doing things. People start not just thinking different ways, but really kind of, you know, whatever, deep processing and reproducing the world in these increasingly scientific, or at least no longer, quote-unquote, you know, superstitious kinds of ways. And so then it's almost like that phenomena has to find, it's not just that it finds another mask to wear, it's that the phenomena itself kind of changes a little bit, or it seems to possibly change a little bit. And then that's too partly what you're tracking. It's not just like, oh, here's religion again, you know, putting on the mask of science or putting on the mask of popular culture. It's that the whatever is behind the religious forces, the religious experiences, has to kind of like change its dynamics or something. Does that make sense? Is that too off?
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. That is what I'm doing in the book. I mean, it's not just a matter of the science as a mask of the mysticism. It's that the mysticism actually shifts, and that. So let's take a better example. Take evolution. You know, when Barry Windsor Smith or Philip K. Dick or Jack Kirby or somebody has an altered state of consciousness, and they experience themselves as an expression of some kind of elan vital or cosmic evolutionary force, I don't think they're lying. I think their mystical experience really was like that. They experienced themselves in an evolutionary process going back millions and billions of years. Now, nobody can talk like that. Was that experience possible 3 centuries ago? I doubt it. I doubt it. You know, so what you're actually seeing here is that technology and science have made new kinds of religious experiences possible.
Well, and I think vice versa, those mystic experiences described in that scientific language also make scientific advances possible. Like, I always like the example of Wonder Woman, right? The lasso in Wonder Woman, her, like, truth lasso, is actually what helped inspire the lie detector machine. And, in fact, the writer of Wonder Woman helped this other dude, and they made it together. So not only does that language kind of open up those possibilities for religious experiences, but it goes the other way around too.
Right, it's a loop.
Yeah. Like Wonder Woman's loop.
another line into this. I'm still curious. You mentioned your midlife regression, and that too is an important story. I'd love to hear a little bit about what was happening in your own head as you kind of, you know, went back and started looking at your. I mean, I don't know if they were the same comic. The same actual, you know, editions you had when you were a kid, or you had them in boxes somewhere, or you've always had them on your shelf, and maybe there was something that you just kind of kept as a little place to return to on occasion that had nothing to do with your adult, you know, scholarly work, and then suddenly they start to glow or something. Like, how did you find yourself, like, returning to comic books as a site to see these transformations?
Well, it was pretty much just like what you just said. I mean, they were literally in boxes, and the frame was embarrassingly, the frame was me taking a box of these actually old Spider-Man comics and Conan comics and selling them in a comic book store in Houston for way more money than I thought I'd get for them. And when I was in the comic book store, I was just so blown away by how far the art had come from when I was a kid, and I was sort of entranced by these die-cast replicas they're making now that are essentially little statues of these figures I grew up with. So there was that, but then what happened, Eric, it's actually, you probably heard, you know the story, I'm sure it's a rhetorical question in some ways, but what happened was, as I was finishing the book on Esalen, I became obsessed with these comics of my youth, and I didn't understand why until I realized that the essential mysticism of the human potential movement is that we all have this human potential in us, but it's not yet actualized, and that things like telepathic experiences or out-of-body experiences are essentially buds of our evolving supernature. And the more I thought about that, the more I realized that that doesn't just sound like the X-Men. That actually is the X-Men mythology. And I was so struck with that. And then on top of that, what historically, Esalen and the Human Potential Movement get going in the fall of 62, and the X-Men appear somewhere in 63, which means they were actually created months before that, probably within weeks of the founding of Esalen. Oh. And so you have a mystical tradition on the West Coast mirroring a mythical narrative on the East Coast, and I just became fascinated with why that was the case and what was going on culturally, and that's how I eventually wrote the book, was through that fascination.
Well, what you're pointing out there, which, you know, I know we've talked about before to some degree, I think even the last time you were on the show, is that there are these sort of synchronicities that are waiting there, that if they, you know, that they don't strike with the sense of like a truly bizarre synchronicity that one might have individually, but they're almost like, you know, synchronicities in the archive. And they happen in science, you know, people come up with the same idea at the same time and within days sometimes in different places, and television is like, there's a number of like very interesting things that seem to be just kind of in the ether, and particularly if you're studying this kind of material, it seems like the material itself lends itself to these weird kind of connections, you know, things happening at the same time, and there's all the weirdness of pulp science fiction stories describing, sometimes in great detail, events that will later be reported as actual UFO encounters by people who could not have known that material in any way. So there's this weird way in which fiction or fictions or something like fiction enter into the story in a very uncanny way. And I'd love to hear you, because I know more things like that happen to you, or ways of reading, the way that reading this material kind of brings you into that magical space of sympathetic connections.
Right. So just to complexify or nuance the story, I mean, what happened was, so I wouldn't call the resonance between the West Coast and the East Coast mysticism and mythology a synchronicity, because I think there's good historical reasons why they were both doing the same thing, but I think it's still quite striking. The actual synchronicity, though, that led to the writing of this book was a very personal one and a very funny one. I was actually at an X-Men movie in the summer of 06, and I was just finishing the Eslin history. And I was sitting through that film in the movie theater, just sort of blown away again about all the resonances between the evolutionary mysticism on the West Coast and the evolutionary mythology on the East Coast. And I went into what, you know, a kind of this zone. Writers and people often talk about you feel like you're in the zone, and you become sort of acutely aware of your surroundings. And I kind of walked out of the theater in a daze, and I walked to my minivan. And there was something glowing. This is where your glowing book metaphor works, Eric. There was something glowing right below my minivan driver's door. And I looked down, and I thought it was a cross at first, because it looked kind of like a cross. But I picked it up, and it was an X. It was a golden X from a piece of costume jewelry that someone had lost or run over. And of course, you know, that's the X-Men, and I just took it as like this little tiny sigil or this little tiny sign that had sort of taken me over the top of this resonance I was seeing, and so that was sort of the beginning of the book, I think, creatively.
And so how do you think about stuff like that?
Well, that's
at the end of the day.
How do I think about it?
Yeah, like you have this kind of the symbol arises in the midst of your daily activity that, sure, maybe it's chance, sure, whatever that means, but it, like, arrives, it hits you with the force of a kind of, if not a revelation, at least a secret wink from the universe.
Right. Well, I don't see, to me, that's like a tiny little humble paranormal event. It's, you know, I'm not levitating a table or anything or knowing somebody's dying 1,000 miles away, but clearly whatever psychic state I was in at that point was keyed into the physical environment in extraordinary ways. And, you know, did it cause me to park where I parked? Did it teleport that little X in from somewhere else? I mean, I don't know. All I know is the coincidence was so far beyond any reasonable coincidence that it had a profound effect on me. So I take it quite seriously. Regardless of how small and insignificant those moments seem, they can have actually life-changing consequences if you pick up the X and do something with it. So it really comes back to our own freedom and our own decision to interpret and to engage one of these experiences and take it seriously.
Well, and it's true. I think a lot of people could have picked up the X and just been like, oh, it's just junk, and maybe not made the connection. But I think what happens, it's like you said, it's that when the synchronicity happens, a lot of people are like, well, why? What's it good for? Like, what does it do? You know, and it's the purpose of the synchronicity is that moment where something inside and something outside are the same.
Right.
When you can have a moment when something outside and something inside are lining up and exactly right, that moment is what it's all. It's not that it's going to, like, you know, lead you to some trail and have a treasure at the end. That moment itself is the treasure that causes this, like, kind of, like, blow up in your mind that makes it bigger, to include like kind of more possibilities and more space. And then what you do with that, like you said, like it's what action is that going to cause you to take. I think that's where it kind of like can goes into magical places.
Right, and remember, to sort of use your metaphor, the path, you only have to change your direction a few degrees now to get to an entirely different place years from now. Right, it's just, you can just use the triangle metaphor and see that it only takes a little shift to have major consequences. So a little piece of costume jewelry in a hot parking lot might be all it takes. But people have, you know, mind-blowing experiences too that have similar effects, but that was not one of them. That was small and hidden in some way.
But in a way, it's almost the smallness that is appropriate, yeah. You know, for your topic in a way. Because I think one of the things that happens, one of the reasons that we we're sort of blocked on talking about this paranormal side of things is because we don't have a way of we don't have a good net. So we just don't. A lot of these things happen throughout the day in very mellow ways, not things you're going to build a theory on, but they're going on. But we don't really have a way. We don't know where to categorize them. We're like, oh, it's some weird thing. Oh, and then people also forget about it. You know, they don't remember even these extraordinary experiences because it doesn't fit in to the rest of their more ordinary way of like organizing the memory of how they live. And yet, in a way, it's almost the small stuff that can be more significant than the big things in over time or for a culture at large, where most people are not levitating tables or doing these other things. And in a way, I think that's part of what people are drawn to science fiction and, you know, other kinds of genre literature in the first place, is because it's a place where you can sort of actually locate those experiences and identify with them, but it's safe for the modern person because it's inside the, or it seems to be safe for the modern person because it's inside the, you know, it's inside the book or it's inside the movie. There's a frame between me and it. Once I go in that, I'm actually kind of a different person. I can actually appreciate things and experience them in a different way. But what your book points to is how those two worlds leak into one another, or how the so-called fantasy world actually leaks in to this real world, which happens to so many of the authors you're talking about. And we're not
right.
really talking
no, I think,
about that part.
I think that's absolutely right, and that's essentially magic, in which you're essentially authoring reality on some conscious or, I think in many cases, unconscious level. And that, as you know, Eric, that's a constant theme of my work, is that writing and reading are themselves potentially magical activities, and things happen, you know? Things really happen when you engage text in certain ways or when you try to construct your own.
So what are, I'd love to just hear like one of the stories in terms of the things you talk about in your book. We haven't gone and given people too much of a flavor of the kinds of stuff that's in it, but like maybe one example that's demonstrating this thing we're talking about stories leaking into other, from one side to another, or, you know, particularly, whatever, rich examples of that kind of slippage.
Well, just to kind of give you two examples quickly, one an author and one an artist. You know, I opened the book with Doug Mensch, who's a really well-known comic book writer who in the late 70s was working on a Planet of the Apes issue and had just written out a story about a gorilla named Brutus who broke into the human hero's home and grabbed his wife by the neck and held a gun to her head and to manipulate the hero. And just as Doug finished that story, put his pencil down or his typewriter, whatever he was on, his wife called for him in the kitchen, and he was a little concerned because her voice was a bit off, and so he went to see what was up, and there was a man in the kitchen holding his wife by her head with a gun to her head, wearing a hood just like the character he had just written. So what do you do with that? Did he write reality, or did he have some kind of precognition that his psyche couldn't communicate directly, so it came out as a fantasy that he wrote out? Well, regardless of how we read that, that had a profound effect on him as a writer, as a human being, as a husband. He couldn't write for months because he was so afraid of fantasy as something that could become fact. So that there's a case of a writer. In terms of artists, artists are really interesting. A number of the artists in the book actually employ this sort of bilateralization of the brain that people talk about, left brain, right brain stuff. And the artists see their work with images as complementary to the writer's work with words. And in a lot of psychical techniques, going back to automatic writing and automatic drawing and even remote viewing in the 70s and 80s with the spying, you use drawing to access the cognition that's coming in. And so with a figure like Barry Smith in the early 70s, who's drawing the Conan comics, he actually had two massive 3-year precognitions drawing Conan the Barbarian in London, where the page he was working on actually disappeared below him, and he has this vision of this street scene while he's drawing. And the way he thinks about that is that when he draws, it's a kind of mild altered state anyway, and things are coming in that you don't quite know what to do with. He saw the vision as just a kind of daydream, but then 3 years later, when he was living in New York, that exact scene played out in the street below his office. So,
there's also one of the etymologies of draw that a lot of people forget, and I think this is more its magical senses, to attract, how you draw a crowd.
Right. Yeah.
And when you draw something, you're actually attracting that thing to you. And back in the day, that's you would look at shamanic uses of cave drawings and it was done like a spell to make something happen, and certainly when you put drawing and text together, in some kind of hieroglyphic manner, it's like that can attract the thing to you.
Right.
This is great stuff. We got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Kripal about superheroes and other new streams of popular culture, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Kripal about superheroes. And we've kind of mentioned some of the amazing stories that people have told you, Jeffrey. And I'm curious, I know there was that amazing synchronicity that happened to you with Eslin and the X-Men. But apart from kind of being privy to hearing about a lot of these stories, I was wondering if you personally ever witnessed a kind of super event or experienced one kind of happening to yourself. Has that ever happened, or has it mostly been through stories?
No, I think most people who study these things study them because they happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly the situation in my case, I opened the book. I'm not telling you any secrets that I had a kind of, one of the themes that I tweet at great length in the book is what I call the myth theme of radiation.
Mm.
And this is the mythical trope where the hero receives his or her powers through some kind of non-ordinary state of energy. And that might be a lightning strike, that might be a UFO encounter where one's body is vibrated or radiated in some way. That might be a radioactive spider or a bomb blast. I mean, there's all kinds of ways it's framed mythically. But in fact, that's an incredibly common trope in mystical literature around the world, where someone has an encounter with a deity or with some sort of altered state, and one feels one's body being transformed by some sort of energy. And that was basically what happened to me in Calcutta in 1989, when I was there studying a tantra and a Hindu goddess named Kali. I was engaging in Kali Puja there, the ritual festival around Kali, and I went to bed and woke up in the middle of the night, but my body didn't wake up. I essentially woke up asleep, and this weird, extremely powerful energy sort of came over me and began to essentially work into my cells and my body and until the point where I thought I was dying, actually, and to the point where I left my body, or I had an experience of being outside my body. And I eventually got back in, and when I got back in, I woke up, and I could still feel my body just sort of vibrating from this weird energy. And that was one of the experiences out of which I wrote my first book, actually, a book called Kali's Child.
Hmm.
And so that experience has always, it really has never left me. I think it in some ways rewrote me or reprogrammed me, as Philip Dick would say. And it's through that experience that I can really sympathize deeply with people who report similar kinds of energies, whether it's, you know, in the bedroom in a dream, or whether it's, you know, it's some kind of UFO encounter or whatever it is. I understand that intuitively because in some sense I've been there. So no, I'm not, you know, people think academics are just boring talking heads without hearts or bodies, but in fact we're people too, and particularly those of us who study really strange religious things, most of us are really strange, and that's why we do what we do. We're mutants, as I like to say.
It's true. I mean, that's what I love asking people that, just because there are some academics that are like very kind of removed and aloof from it and just think it's fascinating. But then the ones that really kind of get into it, in my experience, and the ones I really enjoy, they've had some crazy thing, you know, whether it's Mircea Eliade, like getting involved in the tantric group in a crazy way, or, you know, you have to kind of like do it to really get the wisdom from the data. So whenever people can kind of describe like things that you're describing, it usually is the case that they've had something like that get into their body and an experiential level. And do you think it would be possible with the cities, like for someone to, it is usually described as electrical or like radioactive or some kind of outside energy force, and a lot of that I think was like atomic, which is interesting because in the city stuff there are like descriptions of atomic level things, like you can shrink your body down to the size of an atom, as in the like Yoga Sutras of Patanjali and stuff like that. Do you think there has to be like that outside kind of force, whether it's mystical or religious or electrical or radioactive? Does anyone ever have these kind of things just kind of internally generated in your experience?
Well, I think it's possible that most of them may be, in fact, internal, even though they're experienced externally. So for example, my experience was of an external energetic presence hovering over me. But that does not mean that there was, in fact, an energetic presence hovering over me. It might have been all within my own body, and that my psyche was, you know, creating essentially a superhero comic around those internal energies that were very real. I'm not suggesting the energies are not real. I think they're
right.
They're
well,
ultra
and that's
real.
Like that's like the incubus, right? I mean, that phenomenon that happens to you is described so prevalently throughout history, you know, that it is. There's like not a doubt that it's a real thing. But yeah, that's the thing is like, is it outside? Is it inside? Is it
well,
both,
you see, that's,
you know?
That's the nature of the paranormal. Is that question you just asked? Is the wrong question, because it's both inside and outside, or there is no inside or outside experiences.
Right.
I mean, they're fundamentally paradoxical. They're fundamentally subversive to the way. See, we tend to think of ourselves again as this like little bitty ghost locked in a skull, looking to the outside world, and there's a kind of dualism built in there. And I think what a paranormal experience suggests strongly is that simply isn't the case. And so how do we think about that if all of our grammar, if all of our logic, if all of our rationalisms need dualism to work at all, how do we think about something that's not dual? You know, that's the problem. And so that's where art comes in, and that's where narrative and story come in, and I think that's why they're so powerful here.
Well, let's push on that a little bit more in terms of, I mean, particularly when you know, because you are in, you know, you're one of the things that comes out of being in the academy is that you're, you know, constantly in this web where the sort of dominant narratives of the society are prevalent. I mean, it's,
right.
That's part of what it does. So it's
right.
Like, you, this is
sure.
Where we have science. This is where we have, you know, and the sort of objective ideas, the rational ideas, the notions of, you know, critical discourse, of the modern as being separate from these earlier periods of life and earlier periods of human experience where there was more suppleness around certain of these issues. And so you're working on this material. You recognize that it has this fundamental paradoxical quality. You're not falling into the trap of the literalists on the sort of psychic paranormal side to say, we'll finally be able to get the perfect experiment and then everybody will see that we're right and there'll be this revolution. You know, that kind of idea comes up in the UFO culture or whatever. It just doesn't really seem to work like that. It seems like this stuff is just inherently paradoxical. And yet, there's still this question of how do you bring it into engagement with the more skeptical, the more sardonic, the sides of society where they wouldn't even begin to think that it's even legitimate to even begin asking these questions. So do you think it's a battle worth fighting, or is it something you just kind of do what you do and the people who are going to, you know, pick up on this sort of emerging paradoxical way of thinking about it are going to be informed and inspired? You know, what do we do with that paradoxical form of knowledge in a society that's obsessed with more concrete forms of knowledge?
Well, this is, you know, at least what I think I'm trying to do is just talk about these things in a way that can make some sense of them without falling into the true believer or the debunker traps. And my experience is that most people are in fact in the middle, and once you start talking about it in a sensitive, nuanced, and yet critical way, that people come out of the closet, as it were, and they're really happy someone's finally talking like this. So I think it's about, Eric, I think it's about, If you think of this sort of discourse or this sort of cultural debate we have, if you think of it as a forest where you can't even, you know, see where all the trees are, I think of it as kind of creating a clearing in the forest that, you know, maybe I'll get a couple hundred square feet cleared out before I, you know, disappear. And then someone else can come along and clear out a little more and a little more. And pretty soon we'll have, you know, a place where lots of people can live and can feel more, can authorize their own experiences in a way that right now they're just demeaned and humiliated and shamed by these grossly simplistic views of the debunker and the believer. So I see the writer as an activist. I see the intellectual as someone who is, you know, given a little authority by the culture, for rightly or wrongly, but still have a little authority to kind of use that in a creative way.
Does that make any sense? And part of that comes about with a certain kind of empathy or willingness to let people's experience in their on their own terms have a kind of validity, that there's sort of an affirmation of
right, but there's also I'm making a wager, and the wager is that the debunkers are bluffing, and that the believers don't really believe. And in other words, I'm making a wager that actually the message in the middle is extremely persuasive, and that lots of people will be persuaded if it's articulated in a sufficiently nuanced way.
Well, and also with wisdom and experience, like to me it's like the believers, a lot of them will just believe in something that they think is there, but they haven't quite felt it and they don't really know. Then the debunkers are like, they don't really think something can happen, but they don't really know either. And the middle, I think, is when you actually go like, well, let's check it out, you know, and then you can like say, like, this is what I found.
Yeah, the other thing that I'm trying to do is, one of the things I've discovered just talking about these things in the academy and in university circles is you can't reason your way to this.
Mm-hmm.
Logic cannot get you there, because the logic and the reason of say the debunkers is actually perfectly good. It works really well. They're rationally, logically, they're often correct. The problem is that reality doesn't correspond to reason or logic often.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've found is, when I talk about these things, what happens is people don't step up. It's not that people step up and want to have an argument. They step up and they want to tell you a story.
Mm.
And the story they want to tell you is the weird, uncanny, mind-boggling thing that happened to them. And so you end up just listening to lots of stories, and at some point you realize, well, that's the argument. The argument is the stories. These are real experiences that happen to real people. And yes, they violate what we think of as science today or reason today, but in fact they're part of our world too. So maybe we need to expand what we think of as reality. And so that's not a very satisfying answer, but I think that's essentially what happens. And that's why, again, these comic books and these science fiction novels are so important, is because what you can't communicate through reason, you can communicate through story.
Hmm.
But it's interesting, because it seems like one of the things we do, when you think about how, what is knowledge, where does it happen, what dimension does it happen on, that increasingly it seems like people recognize that story is kind of fundamental, at least to the way humans are, the way we are, the way we organize our memory in time and space, and that there's a kind of irreducibility to story. And so it makes sense that in a way part of what you have to confront in order to make this move into this kind of embrace of paradox is that part of the irreducibility of the story as a way that we organize our experience, our identity, our sense of the world, is that that story has some very uncanny, or can have some extremely uncanny aspects to it. Just the way you read a story, where there's, you know, a synchronicity happens in the plot, or all things get woven in together, or there's some allegorical level where it's operating on a level of ideas as well as, you know, a realistic story of age that's moving through space. And it's like, if you really embrace the story in the full sense of the story, you can't help but bring on board some of these things that are always going to elude, or perhaps always going to elude, the more, whatever, rational or systematic way of organizing knowledge of our world.
It's the presence of mystery. It never goes away.
Well, but see, the problem is that one school of thought, well, there's what we call promissory materialism, which would respond to you and say, well, there really are no true mysteries. There are just things we don't understand yet.
Mm.
And eventually we'll be able to explain everything through scientific materialism. Okay? So that's one response. That's not what I'm saying, and I know that's not what you're saying. What I'm saying is that there are aspects of reality that are fundamentally closed to any kind of form of knowledge that has a subject studying an object out there.
Mm.
And so the challenge is greater than, well, we don't know some things, but eventually we will. It's no, that we can't know these things within this form of mind, within this form of knowledge. And again, that's why story is so important, because it can escape the parameters of those rules, as it were.
And how has the response been to the book from the coast to coast crowd to the scholarly crowd?
Well, the blogosphere has been very kind to it. I've done a lot of interviews, a lot of radio, a lot of blog interviews, and And that's been very kind. I've just seen one review of it in Times Literary Supplement in England, and it was very positive. I don't, you know, academics take forever to review a book, as you know, Eric. We won't see those for a year or so. My experience of this book will probably be like the last one, Authors of the Impossible, where I found academics remarkably receptive and appreciative. Basically, their line was, look, we know this stuff happens, we just don't know how to talk about it, and I'm so glad you're talking about it. That was basically the response of the last book, which was on the same idea, the paranormal.
And so where are you going now in your studies? Where is this journey through popular culture and superhero led you?
Well, look, I've written two books now on the paranormal, and I think I'm done. I think I said what I wanted to say, and I'll go on and do something else now. That's just kind of how I work. I don't find it creative to stick with the same idea theme for more than 5 or 10 years. So I'll do something else. I'm actually working on a textbook now, as you know. So
But you still keep up your relations with Esalen. In some ways, you're kind of part of the Esalen mission. Would you say that Esalen was sort of unusual for you, and that you started off with it being the object that you were studying, and that in some ways it actually really became a part of the current that you are.
Well, I would go further. I'm not in some ways part of Esalen. I'm part of Esalen, and I mean in that sense that it's deeply informed my worldview and my work. Really, all three of my last books are about Esalen. And the human potential movement. I mean, there's, of course, the history of Esalen. But remember, both the author's book and the Mutants and Mystics book came out of that same experience of doing research there. And a lot of these figures I treat in the Mutants and Mystics book, I actually met at Esalen by inviting them there through these private symposia I helped lead with Michael Murphy. So no, there's probably no greater influence on my, at least my work of the last 10, 15 years than Mike and Esalen. And I've been very explicit about that. That's no secret.
And can you, if you would like to, share with anyone, are there any, like, daily practices you do to try and get, like, you know, any X-Men ability that you'd like to share?
You know, I do have a practice. It's nothing I don't think I'd want to share.
That's okay.
I mean, yeah, I tell people too, and I'm very sincere about this. They just see me as an egghead when I say this, but I write every day, and I see writing as a mystical practice. I see it as deeply informative of my psyche and my place in the world, and it's also as Stephen King pointed out, it's a form of telepathy. Because I can write something, I can publish something in 2011 or 12, and somebody 50 years can pick it up and completely recreate the state of my mind then. So writing is telepathy in my book. So that's my practice. That's my most fundamental practice.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. I think it's pretty cool. I mean, my basic line is we have no idea how weird and strange reading and writing truly are.
Oh, man, that's the truth. I mean, look at the Bible, for crying out loud.
Yeah. So.
Do you have a specific practice of reading as well? I mean, beyond, you know, the fact that you're reading stuff all the time, but is there a way in which you have sort of allowed or opened up for the more unusual or spiritual forms of reading that are available?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Arthur Koestler used to talk about the library angel, and the library angel is this phenomenon a lot of writers and readers have experienced, where sometimes a book literally falls off the shelf,
mm-hmm.
or you just open a book and there's the page that you were, or there's the idea you were looking at, you didn't even know it was in that book. So, you know, it's like the X I found in the parking lot. I follow the library angel, and wherever she goes, I go. And I think that's why every book I write is so different, is because she doesn't seem to be interested in sticking in the same part of the library. She keeps going elsewhere.
Well, that's wonderful.
I just wanted to mention, too, that's actually in the tantric material, those are the dakinis. The dakinis are the library angels that take the text to the yogis, right? So that's an old story.
I'm a big fan of dakinis, let me tell you.
I think Jeff's dakini looks a little bit more like Wonder Woman, though. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much, Jeff, for being on the show again.
Hey, thanks for having me, folks.
Good luck with the Mutants and Mystics from me and Maja. Keep your minds open.
All right.